Imagine walking into an intensive care unit. The monitors are glaring, alarms are chiming, and the patient in the bed is just struggling for every single breath because their lungs are failing.
It's a terrifying scene, honestly.
Right. And you might assume that in modern medicine, with all of our scanning technology and lab tests, the doctors standing around that bed know exactly what they're fighting.
You'd think so. You definitely expect precision.
Exactly. You expect precision, but the massive medical study we're diving into today is going to completely upend that assumption for you.
It absolutely will, because when you enter this specific world of critical care for patients whose immune systems are compromised, precision often just it vanishes.
Yeah.
You're stepping into diagnostic muddy waters, and you know, when a patient is critically ill, those muddy waters are the most dangerous place to be.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have a stack of notes covering a truly monumental piece of medical research.
A really heavy but vital topic for us to get into.
It really is. It's an incredibly comprehensive, massive retrospective observational study, and it's titled Global Outcomes and Mortality Drivers in Immunocompromised Respiratory Failure.
Quite a mouthful, but incredibly important.
Right. And when I say massive, I want you to really picture the scale of this data. We are talking about nearly 10,000 immunocompromised patients. Mm. And this data wasn't just pulled from one local hospital, right? It was gathered from 103 ICUs across 26 different countries.
Wow.
Yeah. And it covers a 6-year period from January 1st, 2017, all the way through December 31st, 2023.
The sheer volume of that data is what makes this so vital. I mean, we aren't looking at regional quirks or a small sample size here.
No, not at all.
We're looking at a global snapshot of human physiology pushed to its absolute breaking point.
And the mission of this deep dive is to decode that exact snapshot. We really want to understand the predictors of survival and mortality when highly vulnerable patients enter the ICU.
Right. Specifically with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure.
Right.
Or ARF for short.
ARF, exactly. Basically, it's a critical condition where your lungs suddenly can't get enough oxygen into your bloodstream.
Which is, importantly, the leading cause of ICU admission for this specific patient population.
Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine your body is a high-tech building.
I like this analogy.
Right. Under normal circumstances, you have a brilliant security system, routine maintenance, an entire protective infrastructure.
Your immune system.
Exactly. But for an immunocompromised patient, their internal security, their immune system, is severely compromised or completely offline.
Right.
Now, ARF, this respiratory failure, is a massive fire breaking out in that building. But because the patient is immunocompromised, the building's sprinkler system is entirely offline.
Completely broken.
Yeah. We are looking at what happens when the fire department, the ICU, arrives on the scene.
That is the perfect way to frame it. But, you know, my role here isn't just to list off the statistics of how much fire damage occurred.
Right. We need the why.
Exactly. Our goal is to understand the underlying mechanisms.
Yeah.
Like, why do certain interventions work? How does the fire actually spread on a cellular level?
Mm-hmm.
We need to understand how this massive trove of global data can practically transform bedside care when a patient is facing this terrifying event.
So to understand how doctors fight this fire, we first have to understand the unique vulnerabilities of the patients walking through those ICU doors.
Right. Who are we actually treating?
The study gives us a very clear demographic baseline. Out of the nearly 10,000 patients, the median age is 64 years old, with a roughly 60-40 split of male to female patients.
Which immediately tells us we're dealing with a demographic that already has diminished physiological reserve.
Just from age alone.
Exactly. Even before you factor in the immune system issues, a 64-year-old body has accumulated decades of wear and tear.
Right.
Their organs simply don't have the same bounce-back capability as, say, a 20-year-old's.
And then you add the underlying conditions that cause the compromised immune system in the first place. And this is where the data gets incredibly specific.
It does.
Just under half of these patients, 48.3%, are battling hematological malignancies.
Blood cancers?
Yeah, blood cancers, like leukemia or lymphoma. Another 38.7% have solid malignancies, tumors.
So the vast majority of these patients are already fighting an exhausting systemic war against cancer.
Right.
And we really have to differentiate between those two because the biological mechanisms matter.
How so?
Well, with a blood cancer, the malignancy is in the bone marrow.
Hmm.
That's the actual factory that produces your immune cells.
Oh, wow.
So the security system isn't just turned off. the factory itself is corrupted.
That's rough. And the solid tumors.
With a solid tumor, the immune suppression often comes from the brutal, highly toxic chemotherapy used to shrink that tumor.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, the body is dealing with immense metabolic stress.
Which leaves the door wide open for the spark that starts the fire. The study points out that infection is the overwhelming driver of respiratory failure here.
Right.
It's responsible for 62% of the cases. A virus, a bacterium, or a fungus gets into the lungs, and because there's no immune response to fight it off, it just runs rampant.
Yeah, and to understand what that looks like, think of the alveoli in your lungs.
The little air sacs.
Yeah, exactly. The millions of tiny balloon-like air sacs that inflate to pass oxygen into your blood. When a severe infection hits, those air sacs become massively inflamed, and they fill with fluid and pus. You can pump all the oxygen you want down the patient's windpipe, but if it hits a literal wall of inflammatory fluid, it cannot cross into the bloodstream.
But here is the statistic that absolutely stopped me in my tracks.
What's that?
Out of all these patients, 53.7% had more than one contributing cause for their respiratory failure.
Yeah, that's a huge number.
It isn't just a pneumonia infection. It's pneumonia plus maybe severe fluid overload, plus maybe drug toxicity from their chemotherapy.
Right.
Wait, how does a medical team even triage that? It sounds like trying to plug holes in a sinking boat, but the water is coming through the floor, the walls, and the ceiling all at once.
This raises an important question.
Yeah.
How do you treat a cascading multi-system failure when standard medical protocols actively contradict each other?
Contradict? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, let's look at the physiological tightrope these doctors are walking.
Mm-hmm.
Say the patient has a severe infection that has caused their blood pressure to completely crash.
Okay.
The standard protocol is to pump them full of intravenous fluids to bring the pressure back up so their organs don't starve.
Makes sense.
But remember, this patient also has inflamed failing lungs. Inflamed blood vessels become highly permeable. They leak.
Oh, no.
So as you pump in fluids to save their blood pressure, that fluid leaks straight into the lungs, drowning the patient from the inside and worsening the respiratory failure.
Wow. Treating one fatal problem actively accelerates another.
Exactly. It's an impossible situation.
Because these patients are trapped on that impossible physiological tightrope, the timeline for survival shrinks drastically.
It does.
And that explains exactly why the outcomes in this study are so stark. We're looking at the critical 30-day window. In critical care data, the first 30 days are the ultimate proving ground.
Right.
And the central statistic of this entire massive global study is deeply sobering. The 30-day mortality rate for these immunocompromised patients with respiratory failure is 47.3%. That's 4,662 patients.
Yeah. It is functionally a coin flip.
A literal coin flip.
You walk through those ICU doors, and your statistical odds of surviving the month are basically 50-50.
That number alone is heavy.
Mm.
But the reality gets even darker when we look at the mystery cases.
The unknown factors.
Right. We just talked about how infection drives most of these lung failures, but the data highlights a chilling detail. In 15.1% of patients, that's 1,490 people, the cause of the respiratory failure was completely unidentified.
What's fascinating here is how the data assigns hazard ratios to different risks.
Can you explain hazard ratios real quick?
Here, a hazard ratio tells us how much a specific factor mathematically multiplies the likelihood of death.
Okay, got it.
For example, if you know a patient's respiratory failure is caused by a severe invasive fungal infection, their hazard ratio is 1.82.
Which makes biological sense, right? Fungal infections in the lungs are notoriously brutal. The fungal hyphae literally invade and destroy the lung tissue.
Precisely. It is a highly aggressive pathogen. But if the medical team cannot identify the cause of the respiratory failure at all, the hazard ratio jumps to 2.16.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Having an unidentified cause is actually a far deadlier predictor of mortality than knowing you have an aggressive fungal infection destroying your lung tissue.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's the ultimate invisible enemy.
Mm-hmm.
If doctors don't know what is actually causing the lungs to fail, they are effectively flying blind, just treating the symptoms while the root cause continues to attack.
Exactly. You cannot target a therapy if you don't know the target.
Right.
If you're waiting 3 days for a blood culture to grow in a lab so you can identify the bacteria, that might be 3 days too late.
They just don't have that kind of time.
No. The data is screaming a very clear message to clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
The unknown is the absolute most dangerous thing in the room.
So knowing that the invisible enemy is incredibly dangerous naturally leads us to the core question. What specific factors tip the scales toward mortality, and what actually protects the patient?
The researchers broke this down meticulously into risk factors and protective factors, and they looked way beyond just the lungs.
Let's start with the risk factors. Some of these feel intuitive, like older age, but they also specifically list things like a higher frailty index score and a higher Charlson comorbidity index score. And then they look at physical states right at admission, like an elevated respiratory rate or falling into a coma by the time of ICU admission.
We really need to differentiate those metrics because they explain the why behind the mortality.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Age is just chronological, but the frailty index measures physiological resilience.
Think of the body like a rubber band.
Rubber band. Okay.
A highly frail patient is a rubber band that has lost all its elasticity. The slightest stretch snaps it. Two 64-year-olds can have vastly different frailty scores. One might run marathons, the other might be bedbound.
Oh, I see. And the comorbidity index.
That measures the cumulative burden of other diseases. Does the patient also have diabetes, chronic heart disease, liver cirrhosis?
Right.
The higher that score, the less systemic runway the patient has to survive a catastrophic event like lung failure.
And coma is a particularly terrifying risk factor, right? Because it indicates systemic collapse. The lack of oxygen in the blood has already begun to starve and shut down the brain.
Exactly. The fire has breached the upper floors. It isn't just about the state the patient is in when they arrive, though. It's also about systemic delays and interventions.
Right. Time is tissue.
The expert data shows that a longer delay from hospital admission to ICU admission drastically increases mortality risk. Every single hour the fire burns without the ICU fire department, lung tissue is dying. Furthermore, the need for extreme interventions like vasoactive drugs to support blood pressure or renal replacement therapy for failing kidneys are heavy predictors of mortality.
This is where we see the domino effect of organ failure.
Right, because if a patient requires those, their hazard ratios for mortality completely skyrocket.
Let's unpack what those interventions actually mean biologically.
Yeah, please.
In severe infection, the body's inflammatory response causes blood vessels to dilate widely. They lose their tone, and blood pressure plummets.
Okay.
Vasoactive drugs are basically chemical clamps. They forcefully constrict those blood vessels so that blood can actually be pushed to vital organs. If you need a chemical clamp just to keep blood moving, your cardiovascular system is failing.
Wow. And renal replacement therapy is essentially dialysis, right? Because the kidneys are failing. But wait, why do the kidneys fail when the initial problem is in the lungs?
Hypoxia. When the lungs can't get oxygen into the blood, the body enters a state of brutal triage. It shunts whatever oxygenated blood is left to the brain and the heart, leaving peripheral organs like the kidneys to literally starve and suffocate.
That's horrifying.
If a patient needs dialysis, it means the hypoxia has already caused severe cellular death in the kidneys. The fire isn't just in the lungs anymore. The whole building is coming down.
Okay, but let's pivot to the good news. The study isn't just a ledger of doom. It identifies protective factors.
Yes, there are protective factors.
And this is where the biological mechanisms completely surprise me. We know almost 90% of these patients have cancer. But the data shows that if you are immunocompromised because you received a solid organ transplant, or because you have systemic vasculitis or connective tissue disease, you actually have better survival odds compared to the malignancy patients.
It seems counterintuitive at first, doesn't it?
Totally. If your immune system is suppressed, you're vulnerable, regardless of the reason.
Right. But the nature of the immunosuppression matters profoundly.
Because it's controlled versus chaotic.
Exactly. A patient with a newly transplanted kidney is taking highly specific medications designed purely to prevent their immune system from attacking that new organ. It's a localized controlled suppression. But a patient with advanced leukemia is dealing with a fundamental corruption of their entire cellular factory, often compounded by incredibly destructive systemic chemotherapy.
That makes perfect sense. The baseline biological resilience of a transplant patient is just fundamentally higher.
Precisely.
The study also highlights protective factors right there in the ICU room, specifically around breathing interventions. A higher oxygenation ratio, which they measure as the PaO2 over FiO2 ratio, is highly protective.
Right. That ratio is essentially the grading scale for the lungs transfer bridge.
Break that down for us.
The FiO2 is the fraction of inspired oxygen. basically how much pure oxygen the machine is pumping into the patient's face. The PO2 is how much of that oxygen actually makes it into the arterial blood.
Okay.
If you're pumping in 100% pure oxygen, but the blood oxygen levels remain dangerously low, that transfer bridge is entirely broken. A higher ratio means the bridge is still functioning.
And surprisingly, the study lists the receipt of high-flow nasal oxygen therapy as a protective factor. But I want to challenge that. High-flow nasal oxygen isn't actually fixing the underlying lung damage, is it? It's not curing the pneumonia.
You're absolutely right, and it is a crucial distinction. The nasal oxygen isn't a cure. It's a proxy metric for resilience.
Okay.
If a patient is successfully maintaining their oxygen levels with just high-flow nasal tubes, it means their lung tissue hasn't become completely necrotic or totally flooded yet.
So it's a marker that they haven't crossed the point of no return.
Exactly. Protective factors in this context aren't always cures. Sometimes they're simply indicators that a body is still capable of responding to non-invasive therapies.
Rather than requiring immediate intubation.
Right. The moment you cross the threshold where doctors have to paralyze you, insert a breathing tube down your throat, and use a mechanical ventilator to physically force your lungs open, the risks of secondary infection and lung trauma multiply exponentially.
So what does this all mean?
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about hazard ratios, physiological tightropes, chemical clamps, but all this global data, it's just noise in a medical journal unless it actually changes how human beings are treated.
Absolutely.
If you or someone you love are ever in this precarious, terrifying situation, how does this study actually help?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the true value of this massive retrospective study is that it provides an empirical, data-driven roadmap for clinicians.
A roadmap?
Yes. When an immunocompromised patient arrives at the ICU struggling to breathe, doctors no longer have to rely purely on intuition or generalized protocols that might not apply to this specific vulnerability.
They can look at the math.
They can look at the data from nearly 10,000 incredibly similar cases. Within hours of admission, they can synthesize the patient's age, their frailty index, whether they need vasoactive drugs, and whether the infection is identified. Mm-hmm. And they can calculate a highly accurate risk trajectory. If the risk profile is overwhelmingly high, the medical team knows not to waste time on less invasive therapies. They escalate immediately.
It buys them the one thing they really don't have, which is time.
Precisely. But beyond just the medical interventions, this data is absolutely paramount for what we call goals of care discussions.
The incredibly difficult conversations with the family.
The toughest conversations a doctor will ever have.
Yeah.
When a family is standing in a brightly lit ICU hallway, terrified, they don't need platitudes. They need profound honesty. This data allows doctors to have transparent, deeply compassionate conversations about the realistic chances of survival. It removes the guesswork.
And a doctor can sit down and say, based on global data for thousands of patients with this exact combination of factors, an unidentified infection, high frailty, failing kidneys, the statistical likelihood of surviving the next 30 days is incredibly low.
Exactly. And it grounds the conversation in reality rather than false hope, mm-hmm. which empowers families to make informed decisions.
Right.
They can decide whether to pursue aggressive, painful, invasive treatments or to transition to comfort care, knowing they're making the right choice based on global evidence.
It turns a terrifying, murky situation into something you can at least navigate with open eyes.
It really does.
So to wrap up our deep dive today, we are looking at an incredibly vulnerable population, immunocompromised patients, where acute respiratory failure is effectively a 50-50 coin flip for survival over a 30-day window.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that the absolute most dangerous thing is an unidentified infection. The invisible enemy that prevents targeted treatment.
That hazard ratio of 2.16.
Right. And we've learned that survival isn't just about what is happening in the lungs. It's about the cumulative physiological reserve of the entire body, the underlying biological cause of the immune suppression, and how quickly the medical team can stabilize cascading multi-organ failures without breaking something else.
It's a profoundly delicate balance, requiring swift, incredibly targeted therapies, and a willingness from both doctors and families to confront hard statistical realities.
Before we go, consider this. This study collected data from January 1st, 2017, all the way through December 31st, 2023.
Right.
Think about those dates. That means this massive global data set of respiratory failure entirely engulfs the COVID-19 pandemic.
Wow, yeah.
A time when global ICUs were stretched to their absolute breaking point, and respiratory failure was a daily, relentless global crisis.
It was absolute chaos in the hospitals.
It was. It leaves you wondering, how much did the sheer chaos, the forced medical innovations, and the brutal triage of those specific pandemic years secretly shape the survival and mortality predictors we rely on today?
It is a profound context to keep in mind when looking at these outcomes. The data wasn't collected in a vacuum. It was collected during a global respiratory crucible.
Definitely something for you to think about the next time you look at medical statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Keep questioning the numbers. Keep looking for the physiological why behind the what. Because at the end of the day, when you're looking at that broken diagnostic landscape, the only way through the muddy waters is asking the right questions. Thanks for joining us. We will see you next time.